States of America versus Devon Cohen. William Sansoni is here for the appellant. Sean Sekinen is here for appellee. And when you're ready, Mr. Sansoni, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. It is truly an honor to be here, especially in the Judge Gerald Choflat courtroom in front of Judge Choflat himself. That is truly an honor. My name is Bill Sansoni, and I represent Mr. Devon Cohen. I was also trial counsel. The facts in this case are essentially uncontested. I'm going to run through them very, very briefly. Mr. Cohen was actually given permission to drive a rental car by the actual renter of the vehicle. He was stopped by law enforcement for running a stop sign. He pulled into a parking lot, got out of his vehicle, and started walking away. Law enforcement asked him to come back. He did not come back. He was arrested for resisting an officer without violence. The officers ran his driver's license, and his driver's license was suspended. The police conducted an inventory search at the parking lot and had the car towed to the Tampa airport where Enterprise was. Post-Miranda, Mr. Cohen admitted he was in possession of that weapon and he is a convicted felon. The government, he was later indicted for one count of felon in possession. I filed a motion to suppress based on the deviation from the Tampa Police Department's standard as to the inventory search. And the court denied the motion to suppress on two grounds. One is the government raised standing, and I actually filed a reply brief as to that. And the district court found that because Mr. Cohen was not on the rental car agreement and was driving on a suspended license, he had no reasonable expectation of privacy, and therefore he lacked standing. And if on the second basis was even if he did have standing, the Tampa police followed its standardized procedures in doing the inventory search. I would like to address the standing issue. As to the rental car issue, Mr. Cohen was not on the rental car agreement, but after the Supreme Court's decision in United States v. Byrd, that court held that even if the person is not listed on the rental car agreement, okay, as long as there's not something else going on, like a straw man situation, that does not remove standing for that person to raise a Fourth Amendment argument. Now, so our position is, as to the rental car agreement, it was uncontested. Sheila Brewer testified at the motion to suppress. She had the rental car for a couple weeks because her car was broken, and she allowed her girlfriend's, her daughter's boyfriend to drive it. So as to the rental car issue, I believe that is foreclosed by United States v. Byrd.
Let me ask you a question about
that. Yes, Your Honor.
So in Byrd, the Supreme Court rejected a proposed rule that the sole occupant of a rental car always has an expectation of privacy in it based on mere possession and control. And the court noted that this overbroad rule would include within its ambit thieves and others. Who falls into the others category?
Well, I believe in Byrd, it was remanded, the case was remanded to the district court to decide whether there was a straw man situation. And my understanding of a straw man situation would be is if a defendant did not have any ability to rent a car. So he sent somebody in to essentially rent a car for him, and that the person renting it would never be able to rent a car, and was never the person who was renting it was never even intending to drive the car. Walk out, give the keys to the defendant. My position, and I think Byrd highlights, is because the Supreme Court says a car thief, a burglar applying its trade, or others. So a straw man situation would fall within that type of other. Our position is driving on a suspended license does not equate to a car thief or a burglar plying its trade. And I actually think in United States v. Walton, which is the Seventh Circuit case, 763 F3rd 655, it was actually cited by the government. It's
the court here followed the Second Circuit's decision in Lyle, right? So if we were in the Second Circuit, you'd be out of court because you're not in lawful possession if you're driving the vehicle without a valid driver's license, and therefore you have no reasonable expectation of privacy. But you say the court should have followed the Eighth Circuit decision in Bettis because you look to whether or not you have a possessory interest in the car. Is that right?
Correct. Driving on license suspended does not affect your possessory interest or your ability to exclude others. There are a vast amount of reasons that somebody's driver's license is suspended. Failure to pay a red light ticket, child support. Our position is merely because your driver's license got suspended and you chose to drive a car, that does not equate to the level that the United States Supreme Court was talking about. A burglar plying its trade, an ambit of thieves. Now, if you go with the Second Circuit's reasoning, driving under the influence would be, you would remove all Fourth Amendment protection because this, as the Second Circuit says, and as the government says in their brief, that Mr. Cohen shouldn't have been driving any car because he was driving on a suspended license. But if you take that logic, anyone driving on a suspended license, I mean driving under the influence, shouldn't be driving any car. So the analysis, there would be no Fourth Amendment analysis if a person was driving a car impaired because they shouldn't be driving any car. And the Seventh Circuit actually highlights this very well in United States v. Walton. And let me just read this quote. The Seventh Circuit says, quote, first, perhaps Haywood and Figueroa España, those are two cases that the parties had brought up, stand for the position that a driver with an invalid license loses an expectation of privacy in any car. After all, driving without a suspended license is illegal. But the Seventh Circuit says that principle cannot be correct. A driver of a car does not lose all Fourth Amendment protection simply because his driver's license is invalid.
So the district judge in here just followed the wrong circuit analysis. You say the court should have followed the analysis that we see in the Seventh and the Eighth Circuit decisions and not in the Second Circuit decision?
Yes, Your Honor.
But let me ask you this question now. Assuming that he has standing to challenge the search of the automobile, why wouldn't the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule apply to this case?
Well, Judge, the only basis that gave the officers entry into the car was the inventory search. Because he was out of the car, he was walking away. This wasn't a search incident to lawful arrest. So if you're asking about the inventory search, the Tampa Police Department only has it's absolutely crystal clear, two types of impounds. There's a police impound where the car is impounded to the police department. And there's a rotation impound where the car is impounded to the wrecker's lot. Those are the only two types of impounds under the Tampa police procedures.
Why would the policy apply if the car was searched at the scene?
Well, because the Tampa police procedures and, Your Honor, in
is it this, true that the car was searched at the scene? Right?
It was searched at the scene, but they were doing an inventory search. And the police procedures, only the Tampa police procedures, there's only two types. Now, the government calls it a quirk.
The reason they did that is because of the rental agency wanted the car back.
Right. They were.
That's why they did it.
That is why they
Otherwise, they would have taken it downtown, I suppose.
Correct, Your Honor. But if you look at.
And impounded the car.
The tow truck took it to the Tampa airport. But if you look at this case, if you look at, the problem is the government wants this court
Your argument is they can't do a inventory search because it went back to the enterprise.
Correct. The Tampa
can't do it at all.
The Tampa police procedures don't call for that. They only call for two types of impounds. And the procedures specifically say the impounding officer will determine whether the impound is a police impound or a rotation impound.
There was no impound if it were, there was no impound though, right?
But then they wouldn't have been allowed to do an inventory search. The only, because Mr. Cohen wasn't in the car, he was away from the car. The only authority that gave the officers
but that doesn't make any sense, does it?
Well, if
it doesn't make any sense to me anyway.
Well, here's the argument. The United States Supreme Court in Florida v. Wells, and let me just draw this out very quickly. The defendant was arrested for a DUI. The car was towed to the police impound. The officers went into the trunk and opened up a locked suitcase. The Supreme Court held there were no procedures in place, didn't decide it on a reasonable basis, said there was no police procedure for opening locked suitcases, so therefore the standardized procedures were not followed, and we found they found the search to be illegal. The question is not just, it's not just reasonable. The Supreme Court specifically said,
let me ask you about that, because that's an entirely different situation. That's where they encountered a locked item within a car. Here, right. It seems to me you are questioning the decision of the officers to tow the car to the rental company, which may have been a deviation of procedure, but I don't believe that you are challenging the officer's decision to impound the rental or the mechanics of the search. You're just saying, you know, once the officers towed it to the back to the owner, that was the deviation. If the officers were entitled to impound the car and search the car, I guess I'm not following what the basis for your objection here is.
Well, the problem is that it has to follow the police procedures. And in the district court, there was absolutely no testimony at all about why the officer did not either find it was going to be a rotation impound or a police impound. He sent it somewhere else and decided to do an inventory search, and there was no testimony as to what gave him the ability to do that.
But you would concede they were entitled to impound the car, correct?
Yes.
And they were entitled to do an inventory search of the car, correct?
Only under a police or rotation impound.
But you will concede they get to do an inventory search, correct?
Correct, I do.
So it's only because they sent it to the rental car company that has caused this concern, this error in your mind?
Yes, Your Honor.
If they had taken it downtown to the police lot, let's say, did the search, and then sent it to Enterprise, that would be all right.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe so, and because they would have followed the procedures. The question, I know Judge Branch and Judge Choflat, it's very procedural, but we can't dispense with when the Supreme Court says you must follow the standardized procedures. We can't just dispense with the standardized procedures and say, well, we just think it's reasonable, even though the procedures weren't followed. That's our position.
All right, thank you, Mr. Sansoni. We'll hear from Mr. Sikinen.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Sean Siakinen for the United States. I'd like to start on the inventory search itself. It doesn't matter that the car was towed to Enterprise after the inventory search had been conducted, and that is undoubtedly what happened here. Because none of the evidence that Mr. Cohen seeks to suppress was found as a result of the car being towed to Enterprise. The policy—
Is that because the car was searched at the scene?
Yes. The policy, which Mr. Cohen does not contest, shows that police were required to impound the car, not just permitted, but required to impound and therefore to inventory the contents of the car because Mr. Cohen had been arrested and there was no one else on scene to release the car to. So under the policy, police might have three options after arresting the sole occupant of a vehicle in a situation like this, but only one of them was allowed here, and that was impoundment. The other potential options could have been, number one, leaving the car where it was parked, or number two, releasing it to a legally licensed driver already on scene. But neither one of those options would have been allowed in these circumstances because, number one, aside from the fact that both of those options under the policy required, quote, competent consent of the vehicle owner, which Cohen obviously could not provide, the policy further prohibited police from leaving the car on private property, which Mr. Cohen does not dispute that this car was parked on private property. And the policy also says the police will not call other people, wait for other people to arrive on scene as an alternative to impoundment. So
where's the evidence in the record that the police department followed standard operating procedures?
The policy itself.
The only thing they did was submit the policy. There was no evidence in the record that they followed the policy.
Because Mr. Cohen did not dispute the policy. So maybe I should take a step back here, and I'd like to talk about everything that was presented to the district court on the inventory search issue. And first, my opposing counsel said earlier that he moved to suppress because on the grounds that there was a deviation from this policy, and that's not right. His motion to suppress didn't make any reference to the policy, didn't allege any violation of the policy. The motion to suppress simply argued that the inventory search was invalid because police could have done all these other things, supposedly, with the car rather than impounding it. And then,
is my understanding correct, is that all the government did was introduce the policy in evidence, and there was no evidence that the policy was actually followed?
The government attached the policy to its response opposing Mr. Cohn's motion to suppress, yes.
That's it?
That is it, yes. So, well, if I could...
All we have in the record is the policy. We don't have any evidence that the policy was followed.
Well, and there's a reason for that, Your Honor. After Mr. Cohn filed his motion to suppress, arguing that the inventory search was invalid because of all these other potential alternatives, we responded by then providing this policy to the court. And this is not a case where the issue was not simply that the policy permitted the police, as an exercise of their discretion, to choose to impound and inventory the vehicle in this case. But more than that, based on the uncontroverted, uncontested facts that were presented to the district court in the motions and at the hearing, the policy made clear on its face that police had no alternative, that police were indisputably required to impound and therefore inventory the vehicle on the face of the policy. So that much is apparent by the time that we file our response to his motion to suppress. Mr. Cohn then files a reply in support of his motion in which he does not object to the policy. He doesn't argue that it was invalid. He doesn't argue that it wasn't followed. The reply brief only addresses the standing issue. And then...
But if there's a finding of fact by the court that the department followed the policy, where's the evidence in support of that finding of fact?
I would say as to the decision to impound and the mechanics with which the search was conducted, that the court, that factual finding was supported by Mr. Cohn's admission or failure to object. It was just that part was just not at issue in the hearing.
The only thing he did was he didn't object to the admission of the policy into evidence. Did he concede or consent that the policy was followed?
I would say yes, although this was not explicitly discussed at the hearing, but I would like to further discuss what did happen at the hearing. So after Mr. Cohn had argued in his motion that the inventory search was invalid because of all these other alternatives that could have happened rather than impoundment, then we provide to the court the policy showing, though, that's not the case. The police were required to impound and inventory. And in response to that, at the hearing, what he argues is simply that the car had not been impounded at all, which was different than what he had argued in his motion to suppress, and is different than what he argues now in this court. At the hearing, I think this is on pages about three to five of the hearing transcript, he argues that that the police had supposedly called Enterprise to come pick the car up, and that because of that, because the police had never taken the car into custody, there had not been an impoundment. Well, again, that's different than what he argued in his motion to suppress, and it's different than what he's argued in his brief here, and it's different than what he's conceded just now. I don't think there's any real dispute that the vehicle was impounded. So at no point in his motion to suppress or at the hearing did he ever take any issue with the validity or the applicability of the inventory search policy or whether it was followed with respect to, number one, the decision to impound, or number two, the mechanics of the search. And this court has held in Sammons that with respect to impoundment, that all that is necessary is that the court, that the police follow standard procedures with respect to that decision to impound in the same way that they have to follow standard procedures with respect to the mechanics of the search. And I think it would be quite an extension, and it would lead to some bizarre results if this court were to hold that in a situation like this, that an otherwise valid, reasonable impoundment and inventory search could be retroactively nullified by something that then happened to the car after it had already been impounded and after the search was completed. And that's what happened here, and that's not in dispute. The police impounded the vehicle after when they arrested Mr. Cohn. They were required to conduct the inventory search, which they did on scene. This is not in dispute. And the only issue, the only deviation here is that the policy said that the car should have been returned to the tow truck company lot. I don't think there's any dispute from the face of the policy or the undisputed facts in the record. It is clear that this was a rotation impound, not a police impound, not some other type of impound. The policy makes clear every impound is one of those two things, police or rotational. And in either case, police are required to conduct an inventory search. And that makes sense because the purpose of an inventory search, two main purposes, to protect police from claims of lost or stolen property, and to protect police from danger. There could be explosives or bombs or firearms in a vehicle that is impounded, as there was in this case. And those concerns equally justify conducting an inventory search of a car that is impounded, whether it's taken to the police impound lot, whether it's taken to the tow truck company's lot, or even whether it's returned to Enterprise.
All right, well, let's go back to standing.
Sure.
And the Eighth Circuit's decision in Bettis seems, at least to me, to make more sense than the Second Circuit's decision in Lyle. If you get stopped in a rental car that you're authorized to drive, let's say you're stopped for a taillight out, or you didn't use your blinker, or you crossed the center line, it seems absurd to say you're not in lawful possession, sufficient to have...
Well, Byrd made clear that being in lawful possession is not enough. What's required is lawful possession and control. Lawful possession and control.
Well, he clearly had control.
But was it lawful? So let's take another step back, and I would point out that before Byrd, which was a 2018 opinion, so...
What if you cross the center line? You're telling me that you're not in lawful possession or control?
I am not saying that. Not at all.
What's the difference?
The only thing that...
Crossing the center line and driving with a suspended driver's license. They're both traffic violations.
Because Fourth Amendment standing depends on whether someone has a objectively reasonable expectation of privacy in the vehicle. That means, according to Byrd and other precedent from the Supreme Court and this court, that it's the sort of expectation of privacy that society is willing to recognize as appropriate and legitimate. And I think that no one would dispute that society would recognize that somebody who drives over the center line or even who is convicted of DUI nevertheless had a legitimate expectation of privacy in the vehicle when they got into the vehicle. And
What if your driver's license expires while you're driving the car?
Well, that's another good point of distinction, Your Honor, and I want to clarify that the rule that we're proposing here is a general rule, as the Supreme Court held in Byrd. What we're asking is that this court hold as a general matter that an unlicensed, that someone who knowingly operates a motor vehicle without a valid driver's license, and knowingly operates, a rental car without a valid driver's license, when they know that they're not authorized to rent it.
Suppose the person driving the car is the one who rented it, or it's his own car. He's got an expectation of privacy, whether or not he crossed the center line. Do you agree?
Yes, if he was on the rental agreement,
Or doesn't absolutely. Have a license.
If he's...
You drive your own car,
yes.
Your license expired. Do you have an expectation of privacy? Why not?
So, meaning if he was an authorized driver, but an unlicensed driver?
Authorized driver, but doesn't
right.
have a license that's current.
Well, that would be a more difficult question, and I think that would also be a much
under Bettis. Question. Under Bettis, he's got an expectation of privacy.
Well, I don't know that Bettis clearly addresses that scenario.
I understand but they're addressing the right to possess the car.
Yes.
Okay, the owner surely has a right to possess it, or the one who rents the car has a right to possess it.
Yes.
And your argument is because the license may be expired, he has no expectation of privacy.
No, that's oversimplifying our argument. Our argument is that someone who is driving...
Well, let's suppose he had permission to drive the car, so you don't have that problem.
Then we would not be arguing, if he was an authorized driver, then we would not be arguing that he lacks standing. We are arguing that he lacks standing because he was both unauthorized by the rental company and did not have a valid driver's license. And to be more specific...
Suppose he had a valid driver's license.
Yes.
Does he have standing?
Yes. And to be specific...
So it turns on something other than possession.
Possession, lawful possession, and control is, under Byrd, lawful possession and control is one of the key touchstones that courts look to, but Byrd makes clear that that's not the only thing that matters because as the court held in Byrd, someone who steals a rental car or someone who is a burglar who's trespassing or others.
Let's back up a minute. He didn't have a license, and that standing alone is enough to deprive him of an expectation of privacy. Is that right?
That's not what I'm arguing, no.
Well, you just said it's two things.
Yes.
He couldn't drive the rental car, and he didn't have a license.
Unauthorized and unlicensed, yes.
Okay. Unlicensed is enough to kill the right to the expectation, I take it, and no standing.
Well, if the court were to adopt that view, then yes,
you're making that argument.
No, I'm not.
You're making a two-pronged argument.
The first prong is
you think it's relevant that he didn't have a license.
Yes.
Okay.
But only because he was also an unauthorized driver of a rental car. We're not arguing that any unlicensed driver automatically loses standing. We're only arguing that the unlicensed
is irrelevant.
Well, if the court finds that he's unlicensed is irrelevant, then there would be standing. Our argument is that
I want to know whether it's relevant.
Yes,
I think
it's relevant,
and that kills the standing.
Because in addition to being unlicensed, Mr. Cohen was also an unauthorized driver. It's not just one or the other. We're only
if he had been authorized and he doesn't have a license, he has standing. Is that your argument?
Yes.
Okay.
But he had the authority of his girlfriend's mother, who rented the car, to drive the car. So I don't understand. He was an authorized driver.
Well, so this is, yes. So the specific rule that we are requesting here is that someone who drives a rental car who knowingly operates the rental car without a driver's license and without the permission of the rental company in violation of the rental agreement, knowingly does so, as the record shows that Cohen did, that is what eviscerates the expectation of privacy. So in this case, the record makes clear that Cohen knew that he was unlicensed because he had...
What if he forgot his driver's license at home and he's a block away and he forgot his driver's license, which seems pretty similar to driving with a suspended driver's license. You got to have your driver's license to drive a car.
Under the test...
Then you're saying...
Under our test, then he would still have an expectation of privacy because the The test that we're proposing would look to whether someone knowingly operated a rental car, knowing that they were unlicensed, and also that they were not allowed to be in the rental car in the first place. That's the test that we're proposing.
Your argument is that the unlicensed is relevant. He's unlicensed, he doesn't have an expectation, period.
Well, no, not period, Your Honor, because our argument is that he's unlicensed and he's unauthorized, both of those things in combination. That's all.
Suppose if he's authorized, it doesn't matter whether he has a license or not, he has expectations. That's your argument. The key to your argument is whether he's authorized to drive the car.
It's both things are key to our argument, because without one or the other, we would not be arguing that he lacks standing. And to reiterate, whether or not he has standing, this was a reasonable and proper inventory search for the reasons that we've discussed. So this court doesn't necessarily need to address the standing question, but if it does, we would suggest that it should adopt the rule that we proposed. And to get to the court's, I see my time is up, but I just want to clarify that I think the court was exactly right. This court, if it addresses the standing question, will have to decide whether Cohn falls into the category of one of those quote-unquote others that the Supreme Court identified in Byrd, and we think for the reasons of our brief that he does.
All right. Thank you, counsel. We have your argument.
Thank you.
Sonny, you've reserved some time.
Yes, thank you. May it please the court. Your Honor, Mr. Cohn, the appellant's position is that Mr. Cohn was an authorized driver under United States v. Byrd. The facts are uncontested in front of the district court. This isn't a straw man situation. Miss Sheila Brewer allowed her daughter's boyfriend to drive the car. At that point, he isn't authorized. He is authorized because Byrd said United States Supreme Court and Byrd said we're not going to get into whether you violated a rental car agreement to decide Fourth Amendment standing. So our position is he is authorized. So the only issue would be whether if driving on a suspended license equates to unlawful possession or unlawful presence. And as the Seventh Circuit really touched in when they said, highlighted Arizona v. Gant. In Arizona v. Gant, which is a huge Supreme Court case on Fourth Amendment reasonableness as to a car search, Gant was driving on a suspended license. And the Seventh Circuit said if driving on a suspended license was enough to eviscerate Fourth Amendment protection and expectation of privacy, Gant would have been an easy case. You never would have gotten to the Fourth Amendment.
You wouldn't have an expectation if you owned the car.
Right.
Under that logic.
Right. But Gant was driving on a suspended license. The court did not even look into the issue about whether that would eviscerate standing at all. It went on to whether the search was reasonable. Driving on a suspended license was not the issue, because driving on a suspended license, as the Supreme Court also said in Byrd, is not tantamount to a thief or a burglar plying its trade. It does not equate to that. But the government keeps saying that Mr. Cohn was unauthorized. That's under the rental car agreement. Our position is Byrd foreclosed that using the term unauthorized as to Mr. Cohn under the facts. He was clearly allowed to drive the vehicle. So he was authorized to drive the vehicle. So the only issue left is whether driving on a suspended license removes standing. And as I think the court in Walton and as the Supreme Court clearly intimates in Gant, is that's not part of the analysis of Fourth Amendment, merely driving on a suspended license. And very quickly, as to the impound, essentially the government's position is you can do away with the standardized criteria as long as it's reasonable. That's not what the Supreme Court said. The police have to follow the standardized criteria, and Judge Wilson was correct. There was no evidence about why the police deviated from the criteria. That's all I have. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Tony, Mr. Skinner. next case is